Hey, baseball fans, go yard with BetMGM, the sportsbook born in Vegas. Enjoy top odds on your favorite home run bets, fast and convenient ways to play same-game parlays, special boosts and tokens, and so much more. From the first pitch to the game-winning fireworks, there are more ways than ever to supercharge your excitement. Download the BetMGM app and get your piece of MLB action. BetMGM is an official partner of Major League Baseball. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER available in the U.S. For New York, 8778-HOPE-NY. Or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. First bet offers for new customers only. All other promotions for existing customers. Subject to eligibility requirements. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need. And 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required. No activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for a limited time and subject to change. Max one offer per account.
Welcome everybody to Positively Trek. I'm Dan Gunther, and with me once again is the wonderful Barry DeFord. Barry, welcome back to Positively Trek, and it's been a little while since we recorded an episode, so...
Yeah.
How have you been, first of all?
I've been really well, thank you. It's been a lot of travel for me. My family and I went south of the border, interestingly, and we didn't run into too many troubles. In fact, most of the Americans we bumped into while we were down there were actually quite friendly. They were kind. They were quite apologetic, actually, due to a number of the sort of political fiascos that we as everyday human beings are enduring. I think the common thread is that we are all people, and there's a lot of really nice people and a lot of really cool things that we got up to. We did see how the other half lives. I went to Galaxy's Edge for the first time, which was kind of interesting. And that was all well and good for a Star Trek fan to go see Star Wars stuff. But outside of that, it was a great trip, and I'm glad that we brought some of the warmer weather back with us, but that has also led to the snow melting away, and now there's a bunch of snow mold on the ground, and it may sound like I am speaking through a lot of cotton, because I am congested from allergies. My goodness, sir. It's been a bit of a rough day, so all that said, I'm very happy to be here, and I've been enjoying some of the other episodes you guys have been doing there recently as well. I have yet to listen to the lore episodes, but I'm looking forward to hearing that one coming up next.
Those lore war comics are a new level of crazy. Like, they're nuts, wackadoo Star Trek, but perfectly suited for a comic. That's what comics are, right?
Perfect. So.
I have not done any traveling south of the border, of course, but I've been experiencing similar sentiments. I have many friends in the U.S. and very similar sentiments from them. So I know a lot of people are going through some very difficult times for various reasons, and my heart goes out to them and to everyone who's being affected by a lot of the craziness happening both on this side of the world and all over the world right now.
True. I think this will be the measure of our travel. I feel like we kind of got in right as the door was shutting, because even since then, I've noticed that there's been a little more heat at the border even just since. So I'm happy we made it, but also happy to not have gone any time later, because it is getting a little more crazy. But outside of that, how are you, Dan? How are you doing these days?
Not too bad. Not too bad surviving. I'm finding the allergies are starting to creep up as well. I think the snow mold affects me quite a bit, and I'm not looking forward to grass season. That's my personal con I have to battle, I guess.
Fair enough. That's fair enough. Definitely. One thing that is great, though, is you and I have been able to make time to watch more Star Trek together, which always lends itself to happy watching, good conversation during, and then usually longer conversation than we both agree we should. But I don't mind the conversations going late into the evening because they always end up being extremely good. So
yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, let me introduce the concept behind this episode before we get going, I guess. I have to say I borrowed this concept or stole wholesale from a recent podcast that started that I've just started listening to and really enjoying. It's from the makers of Welcome to Night Vale. It's called The Best Worst Podcast, hosted by Joseph Fink and Meg Bashwinner. And what they do is actually kind of brilliant. They take an older television show, and their rule is the television show has to have more than 100 episodes to do this. And they go on IMDb and figure out the lowest rated episode, so the worst episode according to those ratings, and the highest rated episode, the best episode. Watch both of them and talk about the two episodes in their episode of the Best Worst Podcast. And I have to say, I think this idea is brilliant. Full credit to them. I'll have a link to their podcast in the show notes. You should check them out. They're very entertaining. They've done, as of this recording, 3 episodes so far on Cheers, House, and The X-Files. I've listened to the first two. I haven't heard The X-Files episode yet, but it's an amazing concept. It's a lot of fun. And I figure we're kind of safe with this episode, at least, because we're going to be talking about Star Trek, the original series, which, as us Trek fans know, does not have 100 episodes. It has 79. So they will, according to their rules, never cover this series. So I think we're safe here. We're not totally stepping on their toes, but still a tip of the hat and a full acknowledgement to the creators of that podcast. I really hope you don't mind that I stole the concept completely from you to apply to Star Trek. So yeah, that's what we're doing.
I also think, like, you know, should they do a Star Trek series with 100 episodes, we're all ears. I would love to hear their take on it. And if they wish as well to bend their own rules and have their take on the best worst of TOS, again, I really feel like, they have different brains than us and different preferences. So have at her, folks. You've come up with a really cool idea that I hope we are paying homage to in the world. They say imitation is a sincere form of flattery, so let's take that.
Absolutely. So with all of that in mind, we're going to start our conversation, as they do on their podcast, with the worst episode. Again, maybe not in your opinion, maybe not in our opinion, but according to the IMDb ratings, so this is the lowest rated episode of Star Trek the original series. It was not a surprise to me when I looked this up and found this to be the lowest rated episode. And I do, in fact, agree completely with their determination of the audience ratings, I guess, for this episode. Season 3, Episode 4, And the Children Shall Lead from the original series. Yes. Yes. An episode that has come up before on the podcast a few weeks back when we did the Say Something Nice About Star Trek We Don't Like. I did manage to find one thing in this episode that I liked for that episode, but this will be a little bit more in-depth discussion about this worst episode of Star Trek.
Indeed. And I can't say I have seen this episode since, like, when we watched it, it would have been a very, very long time. And I don't really necessarily remember watching the episode, though I know I've seen it. The likelihood is it came on when I was playing in my grandparents' basement. They would take care of me after school, and it probably just played while I did something else. because, you know, there were other ones where, you know, definitely like Balance of Terror, my grandpa actually like sat me down and was like, you need to watch this episode with me right now. And so we did, right? Whereas, and the Children Shall Lead came on, and I think he probably went outside to have a smoke on the deck, and I played with Lego.
And also, I do want to say before we get into this episode, there are going to be some things in these episodes that they are a product of their time. That is kind of something we are a generation or two removed from this. And there's a lot of standards of television and tropes and that sort of thing that maybe don't speak to a more modern audience. But all of that said, when we get to the best episode, it is also one I agree with. So, I think even though it is of a different time, I think there are universally some things that make for good television and some things that unfortunately make for bad television. And I think these two episodes demonstrate those in spades. And I think we're going to have a good time talking about this. So,
yeah, I think for starters is... maybe something kind of interesting is if you like the Ninja Turtles, Leonardo from the Ninja Turtles in the live action, Brian Tochi, plays Ray, one of the children from In the Children Shall Lead. I don't think he does a heck of a lot of speaking. He does a lot of crying in the end, but... it was kind of neat getting to see him because he is a very recognizable kind of way he moves and, you know, kind of facial expressions and stuff like that. Obviously, you can't see those facial expressions when he's a turtle, but, he definitely, it's kind of neat to see him in that specific position, which did make me kind of happy in that respect. And I will say that as child actors go, I actually think these kids did an all right job given their situation, shall I say.
So yeah, Brian Tochi, who plays one of the kids in this episode, like you said, plays a Ninja Turtle, actually also plays a Starfleet ensign in Star Trek The Next Generation in the episode Night Terrors, Ensign Lin. So that's kind of cool. Cross-generational, showed up again as an adult in The Next Generation. But I think we should start by giving a brief plot synopsis of the episode, just so people kind of know what we're talking about. So the episode starts in the middle of the action, as these all generally tend to do. The Enterprise crew beams down to the planet Triacus, where there's this archaeological group, I guess, that have all died under mysterious circumstances and in fact are discovered to have killed themselves. Meanwhile, the children of the expedition members are playing and happy as if nothing is amiss, which is, of course, a cause for concern. They beam back up to the Enterprise, taking the kids with them. And it soon becomes apparent that the children are under the sway of a malevolent entity known as the Gorgon, who appears when the kids do some sort of mysterious chant to summon him. And this entity has also given them these powers to kind of influence the minds of the crew of the Enterprise so that they operate controls without realizing that they're leaving orbit and taking this entity to a different, more populated planet and basically wreaking havoc on the Enterprise until, I guess, basically through sheer force of will, Kirk is able to stand up to them and shake off their influence and confront the Gorgon, revealing him to be the horrible thing he is, and basically splashing cold water in the kids' face to make them confront the great loss they've all endured, which I guess banishes the Gorgon. It's kind of unclear. He disappears. I don't know if he's still on the Enterprise, but the danger is over, and the Enterprise manages to avoid delivering him to a highly populated Federation planet. And that's about it.
Yeah. That about sums it up. I think, you know, this episode is very much a product of its season in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. This is season 3. I think pretty much the die was cast at this point. You can tell that the actors definitely have their issues with each other. I think Leonard Nimoy as Spock has basically been relegated to being something of a chorus in the episode, yes. Where he just sort of explains stuff in these like weird highfalutin platitudes. I think you had mentioned sort of something along the lines where he's painting with these extremely broad strokes, definitive statements on evil based on extremely lazy premises.
Yeah.
You know, that when he's trying to explain how the Gorgon works or how these kids are acting and stuff like that, you don't really feel that much depth or that much stake in what's happening. In fact, I think the stakes in this entire episode, that's one of the biggest reasons why it's an issue. We see security guards just sort of wandering around watching these kids pump their fists at people and take control of their minds when these guys are like armed and could do, I'm not saying like to harm a child, like to kill them or anything, but I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Phasers at this point do have stun settings, do they not? Right?
Absolutely. Like, yes.
I think that does beg the question a lot. And I think the, just sort of the apparent, situation on the planet that they're on, and given the behavior of these kids, I mean, they all kind of come off sort of like obnoxious brats, just wanting their chocolate wobble and pistachio ice creams from those funny little cards.
Yeah, there's definitely an aspect of that. And I liked what you said about this being a product of the season it's in. Mm-hmm. Like when we get to it, the best episode is from season one. And the production values, you can very, watching them back to back, you really see the differences. In this episode, for example, they do not have a budget for extras. So there are a lot of scenes that take place in the corridors of the Enterprise. And in the early seasons, there's always people milling about, walking, going about their business and stuff. In this episode, the corridors are very empty, minus, you know, the principal actors in the scene and maybe a security guard kind of hanging in the back observing the action. And the episode, interestingly enough, kind of uses that to its advantage. Yeah. Because I feel like these kids could be very easily overpowered, whether like physically, like, you know, holding a kid and, I don't know, hypo spraying them unconscious or something. Like, right? They're kids. They're at no point in the episode is there anything preventing, really, like, other than the actions of them controlling the minds and making people do things. But in a lot of those cases, you know, Captain Kirk is watching this happen and seems helpless to stop it, even though, like, at one point later in the episode, there's a kid sitting in the captain's chair and he pulls the chair around and picks one of the girls up and and moves her bodily, and like nothing seems to stop him then. So,
yeah.
But yeah, if the ship was full of people, I feel like that would have been a little harder to explain why somebody wasn't just like, hey, you stop that.
Well, exactly. The sparseness is like, once you point it out, you really can't unsee it.
Yeah.
That you do kind of see these aspects, you know, even the interplay between, you know, Leonard Nimoy and Bill Shatner, you can tell, you know, there's a bit of a distance there. There's a bit of, you know, something like DeForest Kelly kind of just disappears for most of the episode. So much like my grandpa, I wonder if he just like left the studio to like go out and have a smoke and then come back like when it was time for him to like show up at the end and be like, well, I don't know what happened, but I'm sure glad it did. And that's it. And it's like, you know, Bones, you could have actually like you say, like hypo sprayed these kids or something into a state of sedation to help them. Right. But what do you do? Right. It's I guess like this is what I like to call like the Dragon Ball writing, where like they just slapped something together. They were probably writing this script like when they were filming the initial like base scenes. Like I mm-hmm. feel like this thing was just slapped together pretty fast with, you know, maybe some good messaging. And I think you brought up some good points that I'll let you kind of bring up kind of near when we finish this one off. It just doesn't feel as compelling as some of the other episodes. And I feel like it is just kind of the worst of them in terms of that, like, you know, the painting with broad strokes, the very strange premise of this weird angel that like gave me like major, like L. Ron Hubbard vibes. And he dresses like a cupcake. And like, I think you pointed it out, like he starts really emoting later, but like the first few scenes with him, like it's clear he's reading cue cards. Like he doesn't even know the name of the planet they're coming from or anything. He's just sort of like, we are now leaving the planet and I will be there for you children, you know, like it's rough. It's really rough.
Yeah, if you summon me, I will come.
Yeah,
remember to do this. I think I felt like he almost felt like a video game tutorial to the kids, and like not a good one, like a very poorly acted one. I did want to just look up, because the actor, and I put in quote marks that played him, Melvin Belli, was actually famous as a criminal defense and personal injury lawyer.
Interesting. Apparently.
And I don't know. I haven't looked into a ton of exactly why he ended up being on Star Trek. I think it honestly was a little bit of stunt casting, because he was well known. He was kind of famous for his defense of Jack Ruby, the man who murdered Lee Harvey Oswald. Like he was a very much a household face. And I think it was literally, maybe he was a Star Trek fan and they like, well, let's get him a role. And, and I had never noticed that watching this episode before, that his acting completely changes between his first and last appearances in the episode. Mm-hmm. So he got some notes. like somebody at some point said, like, you need to move your face a little bit or like turn your head or do something because that first one is very much, he is reading cue cards and, it's funny, even I noticed like when he gets to certain science fiction-y words, he pauses because he's slightly unsure of how to say them. Yeah. Ever since we left the planet Triacus, it's really funny when you start like picking that stuff apart.
Yeah.
I do have to say also, this last time we watched it, you know, a couple days ago before we recorded this, that was my favorite viewing of this episode ever.
Yeah.
Like, folks, watch Star Trek with friends.
Yeah.
I remember the last time I did a full rewatch, I did fall asleep during this episode just because I was so tuned out. But, you know, even bad episodes, watch them with friends. It makes it more fun.
You can Mystery Science Theater 3000 them. Like, like when I'm like saying he gives me L. Ron Hubbard drives, Hubbard vibes, and he dresses like a cupcake is because that's what you and I were talking about when we were watching it, right? The costuming too, like I just to lean into that, watching those kids run around in those weird oily pleather boots, like everything else, they just look like they're wearing these like weird 60s fabric unitards and whatever else. But then these like weird, like oily jack boots that they're wearing. All of them. And there's no real, like, does the planet Triacus require these kinds of boots? Like, why are they all wearing the same weird looking boots, but then also like uniquely wearing their own colors and styles outside of that? That was something that, the whole episode really just unravels really, really fast. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you think too much on it, like, I think the point is I don't think the writers put as much thought into it. So if we go too far into it, we'll start kind of creating like it's nothing exists in a vacuum. Right. So we're trying to fill these little gaps.
Well, I will say that the action and like plot of the episode is very thin. Like they stretch it feels thin, like too little butter spread over too much toast or whatever it is that Bilbo says, right? Like it's so thin as to almost disappear at times where it just treads water for a long time. The pacing is really, really bad. That said, and again, this might be a symptom of looking too much for something that isn't really there. I did feel like the writer had something to say a little bit. So the writer was Edward J. Laxo, and it feels like he's doing a message, or he's trying to talk about, you know, charismatic leaders and the sway they can have over their followers by blinding them and giving them disinformation and hiding the truth from them. Right. In this case, the truth about what happened to their parents and this kind of, I again hesitate to apply the term charisma to this villain who is very much not charismatic, but I think was probably meant to be on the page. And then by the end, you know, unmasking him and showing him for the charlatan he is, and that he's actually just using them for his own ends, and that this wonderful world that he promises that he will rule and the children will just get to play in will never come to pass, at least not in the way that he's promised these kids, right? So there's a thin message there that they just like didn't build enough story around. It's held together by spit and baling wire and not very well.
No, you're right. And I do think there is something there. I mean, you could also maybe bring up the idea of like, you know, society is falling apart when the children start telling their parents what to do, you know? And I think there are aspects of Western society where we have seen that sort of thing kind of happen, right? You know, this is also, you know, the kind of the first wave of the baby boom is now coming into that sort of age range that these children are at in the 1960s too. So to some degree, maybe there's a bit of a ripped from the headlines kind of feel about like, are we gearing our society to pleasing these children and not giving them enough hardship? And if they don't have hardship and they want everything easily, will they become obnoxious little brats who feel like they deserve to get whatever they want and only play? Like, I mean, you're right. There is some pieces here, I guess. Yeah, it's just, it's too thin, but at the same time, you know, it is fun to watch with another human being and especially as another Star Trek fan. I like it how shocked you and I became when those two poor red shirts got beamed into space when they thought they were still traveling over the planet, whereas they had already left and were far, far away. And we were like, where are the fail-safes? But I think much like the message, any kind of consideration for anything just to advance the story, I think was all they were trying to do. Yeah. And they advance the story and then Bones comes out and everybody laughs and that's it. It's a real paint by the numbers. I think you'd even mentioned this would have made a better comic book probably.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. I don't know that there's enough visually interesting in it to be a comic book either.
Yeah, maybe not.
I don't know. But yeah, the transporter operator who at this point, we haven't seen any evidence even that he's under the influence of the kids.
Yeah.
They just, you know, the helmsman has been tricked and has left orbit and still thinks they're in orbit. But, you know, they just post a couple guards at the transporter room and say, beam them down. And he goes, okay, boop. He's like, I don't have acknowledgement that they are on the planet's surface. Oh, the planet's not there. Oh, crap. We just beamed them into space. Wow. Yeah.
Like, and was that Kirk's call too?
Yeah. He goes to the transporter and says, you know, beam them down to the planet. And then it isn't until actually, if I'm being honest, they beam the two security officers away, supposedly into space as the Enterprise is warping through the galaxy. And then Kirk orders them to beam up the previous detail that had been down there. And they're like, well, I can't find them. That's weird because they're not in orbit of the planet. Like,
good Lord.
Beaming the two of them down, it's like, that's about where the planet should be. Send them down, I guess. Like, right? What?
I mean, maybe this isn't the first time Kirk might be indirectly responsible for a transporter accident, if we think of the motion picture, right? Decker was pretty clear. Like, everyone was like, this guy knows what he's doing. You should listen to him. And Kirk's like, no, we're going to do it my way. And then that poor Vulcan and that other person, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And much like the episode, that's sort of how it ends, in a very failed attempt and a kind of a mushy conclusion to all things Star Trek. But if I was to say anything nice about it again, it would be the child actors, Brian Tochi, Craig Huxley, the fist-pumping redhead going around there. He comes back as well.
He was in season one. He showed up as Kirk's nephew in season one.
Yeah. And then he shows up again as the part of the music department for Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and then Star Trek First Contact. So, you know, hey, that's awesome. I'm really glad that And the Children Shall Lead isn't his zenith.
Yes.
Because if that was the case, good heavens, you know, a couple stinkers, a couple perfect showings. So, hey, it's all good.
Yeah, I definitely want to echo your thoughts on the child actors. I honestly think, like, they might have been the best thing about this episode, which is kind of wild to think about.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they were solid. I bought them for the most part.
Yeah, as child actors go, they did pretty well, and I will give them that. So, good job, kids. And you're now older than us and senior citizens at this point, but you were kids then, so good job.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's take a brief break. And when we come back, we will talk about the best episode of Star Trek, the original series. And if you thought and The Children Shall Lead was not a surprise. This one is also very much not a surprise.
Very unsurprising.
Hey, baseball fans, go yard with BetMGM, the sportsbook born in Vegas. Enjoy top odds on your favorite home run bets, fast and convenient ways to play same-game parlays, special boosts and tokens, and so much more. From the first pitch to the game-winning fireworks, there are more ways than ever to supercharge your excitement. Download the BetMGM app and get your piece of MLB action. BetMGM is an official partner of Major League Baseball. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER, available in the U.S. For New York, 8778-HOPE-NY. Or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. First bet offers for new customers only. All other promotions for existing customers. Subject to eligibility requirements. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need. And 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required. No activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for a limited time and subject to change. Max one offer per account.
Positively Trek comes to you each week thanks to the efforts of our amazing Patreon members. If you'd like to help support the show, simply visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. Join at any level to get early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive content. For higher tiers, we offer shoutouts, associate producer credits, and more. We appreciate each and every one of our listeners. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Live long and prosper. So the best episode of Star Trek, the original series, if any of you out there have placed bets on this, it is absolutely the one you're thinking of. Season 1, episode 28. Good Lord, seasons were big back in the day.
Yeah.
The City on the Edge of Forever, of course, written by Harlan Ellison. Although that's a little murky in and of itself, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about. But yeah, the absolute best episode of Star Trek, the original series. I mean, I agree. It's my favorite. I think it's a lot of people's favorite. I mean, judging by the IMDb scores, which is, you know, from people, that seems to be the case. So, Barry, is this your favorite episode of Star Trek, the original series?
Ugh. I would say yes. But I also have to say Devil in the Dark, right?
Ooh, Devil in the Dark is up there. Balance of Terror for me
Balance
as well.
Balance of Terror. That would be like my trifecta of awesomeness that comes out of TOS that really does become, I would say, and pun intended, timeless. They really are masterpieces of you know, golden age television, I would say, in a lot of ways. You know, we say that the writing is a little different. Like, you know, you would really not want to go down the rabbit hole or the kaleidoscope of how this episode would have been written had it have been written in the 90s or now, right? In the other kind of big eras of Star Trek. It really belongs here.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, being someone who has seen other iterations of Star Trek and everything like that, you could say a lot about, you know, what it's trying to bring to the fore, right? There's a lot of that Star Trek hopefulness. Barely any of it takes place on a ship, which seems to sometimes be some of the best Star Trek. It doesn't really happen even in the right time frame, which, of course, you know, We don't need the spaceships to get the message for Star Trek, I think, and I think that's one of the best parts about this episode. So, yeah, and I just think that this was a time when the cast had a lot of really strong chemistry as well, especially between Nimoy and Shatner. They really carry this, but overall, this is easily one of my most favorite episodes of Star Trek altogether.
Hear, hear. Well, I mean, I feel like most of our listeners will be fairly familiar with this episode, but I mean, maybe not. There's a lot of people that haven't watched a lot of Star Trek, the original series, to be fair. It's going to be 60 years old next year. Wow. Okay. I'm going to give you a quick summary of City on the Edge of Forever. The Enterprise is in orbit of this planet that's generating ripples in time, and this is causing actual turbulence and stuff, and Spock's trying to map these, so they're staying in orbit. In the meantime, the helm console explodes, as is wont to do in Star Trek. This might be one of the first times.
No rocks.
No rocks yet. They haven't installed the Cordry rocks yet. McCoy is called to the bridge and gives Sulu a shot of Cordrazine, which cures his heart flutter that he has from this exploding console.
Gives him quite the smiley face.
Yes. Yeah. We get a classic Sulu, like, high on life smile.
Yeah.
Which he, like, if I had a nickel for every time he does that in the original series, I'd have about 3 or 4 nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's still weird. Yep. unfortunately, there's a particularly large bit of turbulence, and McCoy injects himself with basically a ton of Cordrazine, which causes him to go into a crazed state. And once again, problems with the transporter, following proper safety procedures. He fights his way off the bridge, manages to get to the transporter room, knock out the transporter operator, and beams himself down to the planet where he needs to be followed now by the Enterprise crew. They beam down to find him. They manage to find him right beside this large time portal called the Guardian of Forever. And it shows them Earth's past as demonstrating its abilities. McCoy, who has been taken out by Spock's nerve pinch, comes to and jumps through the time portal back into 1930s Earth. And it's up to the Enterprise crew to go back and find him, specifically Kirk and Spock, because at some point he's changed all of history. The Enterprise is no longer in orbit. And they need to set things right. So they follow him back to the 1930s New York, not San Francisco, as it will almost always be every other time there's time travel. But they encounter a social worker named Edith Keeler, who runs the 21st Street Mission, who takes in Kirk and Spock. And this woman Kirk eventually falls in love with over the course of the period of time they're back there. Meanwhile, Spock discovers that Edith Keeler herself is the point of this entire mission, because in one reality, she's killed in a traffic accident. And in the reality that McCoy effected, she leads a peace movement, which delays the entry of the United States into World War II, allowing Germany to create the atom bomb first, and they capture the world, leading to whatever the future looks like, where there's no Starfleet and the Enterprise and all that stuff. So basically the conundrum of the episode is Edith Keeler must die in this traffic accident, but Captain Kirk is in love with Edith Keeler. It all plays out like that. Kirk stops McCoy from saving her in this traffic accident, and she is killed, and they beam back to their future. It's very tragic and very sad and incredibly moving. And yeah, my summary does not do this episode justice if you've not watched it.
true fact. I will start, however, with a mild criticism and then a story, if you'll oblige me. Mm-hmm. I find the mishandling of such a extremely potent medicine, mind-altering drug, the mishandling on McCoy's end of things, just to be a little hollow. Like that mm-hmm. definitely getting him down, and I think that might lend itself a little bit to what Harlan Ellison originally wanted to do with this. I feel like that was a little slapdash, but mistakes like that can actually be made. Mm-hmm. I will not name names, But a friend of mine in university, who was himself quite the smart fellow. He would do well actually on a Starfleet ship. Very, very smart brain. But unfortunately, not always the strongest when it came to just that kind of more common sense, right? Of, you know, say just kind of covering your bases before acting and stuff. Maybe a little more impulsive than he should have been in. He wound up being a structural engineer of sorts and was actually in Colorado. He'd moved to the United States after graduating and was in Colorado just when THC, cannabis, had been legalized. And as the story goes, because obviously I wasn't there, I was told the story by some friends who were down there with him a little later on, and he recounted the story to them about this, where he was on site as one of the managing kind of engineers for the project they were doing, something along the lines of building a retaining wall or something, trying to stop erosion. I can't remember the exact details, but it just so happened that they were having kind of an after get together, and someone had brought a little packet of weed gummies, little THC gummies. Mm-hmm. And without a moment's hesitation, when he had seen them sitting kind of on their own, he automatically assumed candy and ate them all and ingested approximately 180 grams of THC in seconds. Like he honked those gummies down and was found actually by colleagues of his in the woods, like literally having a complete mental breakdown. He spent a while in the hospital. It was a really bad scene. Yeah. Like he was in a state of total psychosis. So to see McCoy acting the way he did, actually, that's totally what that stuff can do to you if you take an entire dose. So ladies and gentlemen and those in betwixt, please, for your own safety, please always know your limits, stay within it, abstain, keep away from children and pets. These things are no joke because they can really do some harm. Yeah. So I would say like that little like kind of inward facing carrying bump stab he does is a little hollow, but if it gets us to the story, honestly, that's the only criticism I really have of this entire episode, to be honest. Everything else is very much a very strong showing on all fronts. So yeah, and then I like how they lone pined the Enterprise. The Back to the Future reference there's Twin Pines Mall, and then it becomes Lone Pine Mall because of the way the past has been changed. But this is a good Star Trek time paradox. I do appreciate how they put this one together, and mm-hmm. Getting it back seemed believable. Yeah. Sadly.
So going back again to what you had said about McCoy and the mishandling of the drugs, I noticed something. Okay, so first of all, I've seen this episode so many times. I've watched it many, many, many times. It's a great watch. And The Children Shall Lead, I've watched many times as well, but not nearly as many. But I never noticed that, I always criticized McCoy for doing that and being really careless there. But I never realized until watching this time that Captain Kirk deserves some blame for that as well. Because they've been orbiting this planet, they've been having all this turbulence and stuff, and at one point Spock reports to Kirk that they're coming up on a particularly large time disturbance now, a huge displacement. And then there's a beat of 3 or 4 seconds, during which Captain Kirk could have said, "All hands brace for impact." And he didn't. And the conversation that Kirk and Spock have is over by the science station. McCoy is over by the helm. It's possible he didn't hear Spock, so wasn't prepared for what happened, right? So I think a little bit of blame can go to Kirk there. You know, all hands brace for impact. It doesn't take long to say, and it needed to be said there.
You're absolutely right. So you know what? There we are. There's the reasoning. It wasn't McCoy's fault. And no, that does actually kind of satisfy me, to be honest with you.
To be fair, I mean, it's still McCoy shouldn't have been holding that the way he was.
No,
but Yeah.
There should have been like a cap or something for it.
Yeah.
Replace the cap, Bones. Replace the cap. But, I mean, it gets us to that awesome 30s backlot. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess it isn't totally 1930s. Like, there are... That backlot gets used for a number of things. Like, you pointed out a shop from, what was it, the Andy Griffith Show?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the lot that Andy Griffith Show was filmed on, and Floyd's Barber Shop. if I remember correctly, is also named that in Andy Griffith and was very visible in one scene where Kirk and Edith Keeler are walking. But yeah, I really like that.
Yeah. Too bad we didn't see little Ronnie Howard running around. Right?
There you go. Yeah.
No, the immersiveness of it, I really did enjoy it. Seeing those 1930s style cars driving around. Like, again, you're seeing a well-funded, budgeted television show with extras and fun actors. The little banter they have with that cop where he actually lets them explain themselves when they're trying to steal those clothes. it's amusing. It definitely paces itself really well. I think you talked a bit about this though, so I'll kind of let you explain sort of what you see in how this episode gets put together versus our previous garbage heap of an episode.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the juxtaposition, watching them back to back, I see why the Best Worst podcast does this. Like, it's very illuminating with them back to back. So the pacing and everything in And the Children Shall Lead was so meandering, and there was just like, it felt like they're filling time, right? Yeah. In this episode, there is not one wasted frame of film. In this, the economy of storytelling is so well done. It's like as an example, the part where I really noticed it was Spock's trying to construct this circuit to be able to read the information off the tricorder. And they've gotten this job sweeping up in this radio repair shop, I guess. And they notice that there's a couple gentlemen working on radios and clocks with some fine tools, and the scenes are just like bam bam bam, one after the other. So Spock says, "Captain, look, tools for fine work." And then the scene fades and it shows Spock listening to a combination lock as he like opens this thing. Scene fades, Edith Keeler comes down the stairs to confront them back at the mission, saying that lock was picked by an expert lock picker, and I, you know, chastises them for stealing it. So in the course of about 30 seconds, the plot has advanced, and it doesn't feel rushed. It doesn't feel like they skipped over anything, but it just really shows you exactly the beats they need to hit to make that storytelling come alive. And it's so well done. Like, the pacing, the editing, all of it, so good.
And they decorate it with good dialogue too. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely the big piece of it is, you know, when they're trying to build that computer with the fine tools and everything, you can tell Spock is hitting wall after wall with his limited resources. And so he's saying, you know, frustrating, locked in here in this exact place and moment of his arrival. They're talking about Bones and even the images of what he did. If only I could tie this tricorder in with the ship's computers just for a few moments. And Captain Kirk is like, couldn't you build some form of computer aid here? And he's like, in this zinc-plated, vacuum-tubed culture. it's just great. Like, what well put. And then, you know, Kirk has this little jab. He's like, well, yes, it would be, it poses an extremely complex problem in logic, Mr. Spock. Excuse me, sometimes I expect too much of you. You know, like,
these, Spock gets this affronted look on his face. Like,
yeah. And I think that's the glory of it is, you're right, there's this economy where they're going from scene to scene in a very fast motion, but also what they're saying is interesting and fun, and it builds character and it builds the relationship between these two people. So, you know, watching this, it's funny, we took fewer notes watching City than we did mm-hmm. The Children, because I think we wound up enamored. Like, there were points where I was like, oh shoot, I need to be taking notes here, my goodness. And like, I started like typing furiously, but at the same time, that's the best, right? When you forget you're here to like review an episode, and we just started enjoying it. I think that was a really great piece.
Absolutely. And your little bit there too, I think, highlights a strength of this episode that had kind of been left on the floor by the time they get to And the Children Shall Lead, which is that strong relationship between Kirk and Spock.
Yeah.
I think we kind of made note of this in The Children Shall Lead, where there's one kind of non sequitur bit in the corridor where Kirk says to Spock, "Come with me, my Vulcan friend." Right? Just like, it's like the writers are like, "Oh yeah, they're friends. We need to like shoehorn a reference in there to their friendship." And it's like, well, okay, that's weird. But in this one, like through how they interact, like in that little bit you just said where Kirk is kind of jibing him a little bit, and he knows how to push Spock's buttons, and Spock knows exactly what Kirk's doing, but it will also motivate him.
Yeah.
That's all wonderful, but then also seeing their relationship through the eyes of Edith Keeler,
right?
I think did a lot to advance the Kirk Spock friendship and relationship here, where she comes to the basement and says, is talking to them and saying like, you two don't realize just how out of place you seem here. And Spock says, interesting, where, ma'am, do you think we belong? And she turns to Spock and says, you? By his side, like you always have been and always shall be. And Kirk somewhere else, somewhere far away, and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But like, it's almost like, and I'm gonna feed a little bit of coal into the fire for the Kirk Spock / fic people here. It's almost like Edith Keeler, who at this point is falling for the charming Captain Kirk a little bit, is saying like, yeah, I like Kirk, but I can't possibly compete with what you two have. You will be by each other's side forever. I'm just right here for an episode, and I know it, like it's fine.
Yeah. Well, to be able to even see that, right, I think that's where you also have the goodness and the realism of Edith Keeler too, right? Mm-hmm. She is able to see people for who they are in a lot of ways, and her total disarming of James T. Kirk, she obliterates every swashbuckling aspect of him. He cannot lie to her.
Yeah.
He can't be at all, you know, concealing of anything with
no
with
guile.
Her. No, none. And I think that's an impressive feat. I don't really know of many other characters that have ever been able to get to him that quickly, at least in, you know, the kind of the original look of Captain Kirk, both TV and movies. I think later there's maybe a few other contenders who come along, but no, Edith Keeler really does. And I think she builds a good relationship with Spock too, right? Like she loves Kirk. You can tell she's falling for Kirk, but she's also, you know, definitely friendly with Spock. And I think she likes him. And I think he in his way likes her. And then later when she gets to know McCoy, we both kind of were like, I wonder if Bones is kind of getting a little interested in this young lady as well, right? I think she had a lot of charisma, the way she's played, the way she acts, the way she can just go in there and help people too, right? Like she has no bones, pun intended, about helping Bones when the time comes, right? Like he comes in looking like the death itself, and the first thing she does is find a way to convince him that it's time for him to lay down, right? I think that's a huge aspect of what kind of human being she's being put forward as, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the big part for sure is that disarming of Captain Kirk, like you said. It's so perfectly illustrated in the scene where, you know, they first meet, right? They run into the building to escape from the cop because they've stolen clothes off this clothesline. And like, she asks them, you know, who are you? And he says, I'm Jim Kirk. And this is, and he wants to come up with a lie, but he looks in her face and just says, Spock. he can't tell a lie to her.
Yeah.
And it's so superbly acted by everyone in this episode. Joan Collins is a wonder here. And I'll go out and I'll say it. William Shatner can act. Like there's no question about it watching this episode. you know, there's a trope in Hollywood for sure of falling in love with someone over the course of one episode and you never see them again. And a lot of times it's very tiresome and it's like, oh, I don't buy this. I absolutely buy this here.
Yeah.
Both because of just the pure chemistry between the two of them. And also story-wise, it's kind of implied, it's not outright said how long they're back there, but it could be on the order of over a month. Like they're back there for quite a while waiting for McCoy and for all of this to happen. And the chemistry between them, I just like a lot of times, like I said, it can be schmaltzy. It can be ridiculous, but I totally buy it here.
Yeah. Well, especially when she falls down the stairs and Kurt catches her like
without even thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. But also like between the actors, like Joan Collins and William Shatner, you buy that. Like when she's like, oh, I could have died. And the way she kind of looks up at him, you're like, oh, and the way he kind of like freezes
like, oh crap.
Right. It's, yeah. That was a small scene, but it was very powerful in its moment. The other one that I like is, you know, she very much carries this ideal of Star Trek, right? Mm-hmm. The ideal of what Star Trek's meant to be. And maybe that's, again, something that we just don't see at all in The Children Shall Lead. There's no real talk about the good, the you know, what humankind can actually, you know, amount to and all this sort of stuff. When she is standing up while all the guys are eating in the soup kitchen part of the 21st Street Mission, she's talking about like, you know, what the future could bring and where we are and the fact that we're close to harnessing the atom. And there's a lot of foreshadowing, right, to why she must die in that respect too. But, you know, her cause was one that is very good. And it's one that Star Trek itself is really trying to push. You know, if you think about it, you know, regardless of him as a human being, Gene Roddenberry really didn't want to see a nuclear exchange. And I think a lot of people in that period of time during the Cold War would be emphatic in agreeing that, no, like we need to start seeing what brings us together, not what sets us apart and those kinds of things. And I think Edith's speech during that period of time when those guys are really at their worst, you know, Western society was in a really bad state in the 1930s. A lot of hopelessness. I mean, it literally bred militant fascism that did almost take over the entire world. So in that respect, I think that that she really shows herself for being a member of the Federation before the Federation, maybe to some degree.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. I think that scene is my favorite in the episode, and it's a very understated scene where, you know, she is giving that speech to the assembled congregation, I guess, at the 21st Street Mission. And you know, part of it is the wide-eyed optimism of a young Star Trek fan watching this, being like, ah, oh, that world, yeah, that's where I want to live. And it is really interesting that she, from her position in the 1930s, becomes a spokesperson for the world that Star Trek portrays. That's kind of cool. Which kind of brings me to something that we had talked about as well, which is the, you know, could they have Gillian Taylored Edith Keeler, right?
I was hoping you'd bring this up.
Yeah, right? Like, in order for her to die, she just has to no longer be there to influence the timeline. Could they have brought her forward to the 23rd century to live out her life happy with Captain Kirk in the future, possibly, right? Which is an interesting thought, because in a lot of ways, from the things she espouses and the things she believes, she would fit in very well in the idealized future of Star Trek. She kind of already lives there a little bit in her mind, right? So I like that as an idea, but, you know, taking it to its logical conclusion, of course, Star Trek isn't that kind of show at this point. It's episodic things. There's not going to be a continuing story here. And B, Edith Keeler on the Enterprise in the future, do we just throw her in a mini skirt and make her another one of the female crew members who don't actually seem to be quite as, you know, don't seem to quite be equal to their male counterparts at this time, even though like we don't really try not to mention that, but like, yeah. Actually that maybe not so great.
Yeah. I actually, in the time that we've kind of talked about this, I'm going to do my best worst, pun intended, impression of Joan Collins. But I think being such a principled, you know, idealist, Edith Keeler would turn and with the, given the option of leaving, she would say, "No, James, my place is here to blaze the trail to your perfect federation. Mm-hmm. I must stay. I must do my job. I cannot leave these men." And yeah. And she would. Like, that's my firm belief now, that actually she, given the opportunity, she would say, "No, you stay with me." Right. Yeah. Or you go and live your good future and I will make sure it happens. Yeah. You know, unwittingly not letting it happen by living. And we know that her living actually kind of, you know, she does the right thing at the wrong time is what they kind of say, which again, maybe I do have a bit of a criticism there.
I think, thought you might.
Yeah. I think there were other ways to stop Hitler before he started his big move. But that is a conversation to be had on a different podcast, because that'll take us down a very long rabbit hole. And I mean, you can't really expect everyone to have like playing what if with history is really a bad idea. I think in every way, shape and form, you know, things happen the way they happen. Playing with it for a TV show is one thing. So to get too deep into it, I think you are kind of doing the story a bit of a disservice. So that's where I'm like, I'll shut my big mouth on that one. But could she have gone to the future? I don't know. I don't think she'd want to. I don't think I think she knew where she had to be and what she had to do.
Yeah. Another thing with this episode I wanted to bring up is it does something that really good television does, which is it doesn't treat its audience like they're idiots.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like this story, you could tell it in a much simpler way where, you know, like you kind of have to put a lot of pieces together to follow exactly why Edith Keeler has to die, right? Like, she starts a peace movement, which delays the entry into the war, which has all these knock-on effects, which eventually means that Earth history turns out differently and all this stuff, right? I feel like a simpler way to do the story would be Hitler was, you know, meant to die at this point or something and didn't. Like, you'd go right for the direct thing. Yeah. Whereas this is a little bit more cerebral. It's a little bit more like you're not seeing like battlefields and big world events hinging on, you know, the decision of a general here or something. It's instead really cool that it's this one person with an idea that changes things. And I don't know, there's just something there that makes me appreciate what they expected the audience to go along with, which television is very guilty of not doing that a lot.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to see. Like, for example, in And the Children Shall Lead, it's like, ooh, big glowy guy bad. You know, yeah. Like there's no nuance there.
Yeah.
This is very nuanced. Like, she's advocating peace, which is a good thing, but it has this effect, which means, you know, like it's a little bit more layers of complexity there, which I appreciate.
Star Trek tends to be really good when there's no discernible antagonist.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
You know, it gets into your head and, you know, to think about it that way of, you know, a peace activist actually potentially changing the course of human history in a negative sense. I don't know. I mean, like, not to say necessarily that this would have been even Edith Keeler the one to have totally done it, but I think there has been political movements that have been using political terminology that have been sheepdogged into bad places, right? Where they kind of lose their way or they get caught up in silly nonsense. And yeah, it fizzles out, which leaves room for really bad things to happen. And so I think on a logical sort of sense, yeah, that this does expect that the audience and sort of see the audience as smart, discerning people who can kind of look at this in a much larger, nuanced way, as you say. Mm. I think where I would want to kind of finish my conversation on all of this would have to be around where we are now, right? 2025, we've 5 years until a special book gets written. I'll let you talk a bit more about that in a second. You know, we are actually in a state where things aren't very good, right? We are seeing, you know, pretty much the knock-on effect of several economic shocks that have hit us. We're seeing a lot more populist-style politics taking place. Like, I'm, you know, even talking about going to the United States recently, you know, I was genuinely worried that something would happen at the border, that we would, you know, obviously, as a person who deals in teaching history and deals in politics and stuff as an educator, sometimes I have to look up websites and look up people of history that you know might be seen as kind of bad or something, right? Like, obviously I'm also discerning enough not to get my brain cooked by that sort of stuff, but you know, there is that worry that that something could be taken wrong. Or, you know, I've been pretty vocal about my opposition to the genocide in Palestine, kind of on my own, mm-hmm. as well. I've participated in movements to try to raise more awareness to that. And, you know, if I lose us listeners because of that, I'm happy to see them go personally.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely.
But I do think to some degree we do have to sort of see the now from the perspective of Edith Keeler a bit here. I think she's actually a pretty good model for the type of person that we need. And we don't need them as gigantic, you know, country leading leaders. You know, think about what you can do in your neighborhood, right? Think about the kind of person you can be to your fellow human being who might be down on their luck. Like, we don't have soup kitchens right now where we are. Like, really, like, we've got a couple littler spots that do help, like, the most destitute. But there's people who are having trouble in their day-to-day who are, you know, gainfully employed, apparently, and stuff like that, who are finding life a lot more difficult, who are looking at the future and not feeling as much hope. Mm-hmm. How do we find our way back from that? Well, I think, you know, episodes like this can do a lot to put things into perspective for us. Not that, you know, oh, well, if we start a peace movement, new Hitler will show up. more that in this respect, that if we actually stick to our principles of being good to one another by showing empathy, by helping our fellow person, we might be able to get out of some of the silly identity politics that we've gotten ourselves wrapped up in, because I think mm-hmm. we're driving towards a brick wall, and all we can do is really argue over who gets to sit in the front seat at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. All absolutely great points. And the best Star Trek does that, right?
Yeah.
Like it shows a model for how to be in the world. And I think you can't have a better model than Edith Keeler, you know, regardless of what purported effect she had on history in this world, she had the right idea, as Spock yep. says. And I yep. think that's absolutely true. I love, this is a perfect time to bring up Joan Collins and her feelings upon playing this character. I actually recently found it because I had a vague memory of the Star Trek 30th anniversary special that aired on television. Good Lord, 29 years ago, as we're coming up on the 60th anniversary, where she reflected on the role. And I'll put in the actual clip here, but she talks about her legacy as Edith Keeler.
I have very fond memories of Star Trek, and I'm proud to have been a part of it. And in fact, when people say, "Aren't you Alexis Carrington, that bitch from Dynasty?" I smile sweetly and respond, "No, I'm Edith Keeler, Depression-era social worker from Star Trek."
And so, yeah, she wants to be remembered for that character over, you know, that bitch from Dynasty, as she says, right? So good. But yeah, incredible role, incredible acting by everyone in this episode.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much in the original series of Star Trek, and I love TOS. I really do. That's how I came to Star Trek, was watching the original series. That was my yeah. original exposure to Star Trek, and I've always loved it. There are episodes and situations where it can feel over the top and hammy and not very realistic. I can't think of a single moment in this episode, even with McCoy yelling at the top of his lungs about assassins and killers. I'm buying it all because I'm so immersed in what's going on. It's so good. One last little thing that came up while we were watching, actually a couple things. So sorry, I forgot there is another thing, but the other kind of flip side of the story of Edith Keeler, this person who had a huge effect on history, right? There's another character in this episode who is inadvertently killed due to the actions of Dr. McCoy. He gets his hands on McCoy's phaser, and while, you know, looking at it, this unhoused person ends up vaporizing himself and presumably is erased from, you know, having whatever future effects he had on history from that point originally, which would seem to be none because his death doesn't affect history at all. And I found myself wondering about the writing of that. Like, how much thought was put into that? Like, was it a juxtaposition to Edith Keeler to show that, like, you know, there are people that just have no appreciable effect on how things turn out? Or was it just to show, like, how dangerous McCoy being in the past is? Oh my gosh, someone died because of it. We have to fix this situation, right? Mm-hmm. I find myself curious as to how much thought went into that and if there was something they were trying to say there.
You know, that's a hard one because we're dealing with a person who is endeavoring to raise up people who have been basically turned into the reserve force of labor in their own society. They are less than human, right? They don't even have the ability to work. They don't even have the ability to make anything of themselves, right? We in a commodity-based society, we have to understand, folks, that in a wage society, we are the commodity. Our labor is the commodity. And these people can't even, you know, that's a worthlessness that you get. And I think, you know, when you see unhoused people, this is the sentiment you sort of get. And as much as you literally have a character who is working to try to raise these people up in the time that they're in, maybe there's a bit of a callousness on the part of the writers still that they didn't even notice that they had.
That's what I wonder.
Because, yeah, I do think that this guy is oft to show how dangerous Bones being in this time is. You're absolutely right. But at the same time, yeah, like, nothing goes missing when he goes. That really does say a lot, doesn't it? So, yeah, I wonder about that.
Well, the last thing to talk about is very much related to all of that and Edith's mission in 1930, right? She's trying to get information out of Kirk and, you know, what's going on with you two, whatever it is, let me help. And Kirk replies, I love this bit. He says, "Let me help. 100 years or so from now, I believe, a famous novelist will write a classic using that theme. He'll recommend those three words even over, I love you." And I think that to me, as I don't know when I first watched this episode, I was very young, but I remember even then that just striking this chord with me. And the fact also that, like, 1930 is when this episode takes place. It didn't really occur to me till we were watching it the other day. We're 5 years away from it being 100 years or so from then. Right. So,
you better get writing, Dan.
Well, I apparently the novelist in question is from a planet orbiting a star in the far left of Orion's belt. So I also have to move.
Well,
I'm going to write that.
I mean, there are probably going to be some issues there, but I feel like that novel can still be written. Mm-hmm. And I think it gets written. I think it does actually get written by people who live that mantra. And I do think that mantra is a form of I love you. Agape love, empathetic love, caring for another human being, right? If you tremble with indignity at the suffering of another person, you are a comrade of mine, right? The beauty of wanting to help other people, like, I like to joke to people that my political philosophy is Mr. Rogers' thought. Be yes. a good neighbor, right? What does yeah. he say when there's crisis? Look for the helpers, right? Look for the people who will help. Mm-hmm. Because that's how we get by. This rugged individualism that we find ourselves in is why the Great Depression happened, right? It was spawned actually in the 1920s. I tell my students the Great Depression does start in 1929, but that's because it reaches a critical mass, right? Mm-hmm. But before that, for 10 years, for much longer than that, people were already losing their houses and their farms and their businesses. And we were seeing that separation in society and that slow drag towards militant, self-destructive fascism that reared its head as the nightmare of the First World War came to an end. We saw an even greater one come beyond that. And I think we as human beings have the capacity and we delude ourselves to think that like, oh, this good thing that this person does for me, what's the catch? Oh, yeah. What are you trying to get at? You know, what do you want from me? And maybe they just want you to live well, because if that person lives well, then they might help another person live well, who might help another person live well. And this sees itself beyond any political ideology to some degree as well. I think we need to get out of our own heads and out of our own little states of alienation and really look to help each other. And I think a novel like that, well, no wonder that's James Kirk's, you know, one of his favorite classics, because that has to be at the foundation of the society he lives in.
Yeah. And there's so much there too, like just those three words, let me help. It's begging the person that it's being said to, not just I want to help you or you need help. It's let me help. Like,
it's reciprocal.
And like you said, I think we are trained, we are brought up to believe that like someone's not just gonna help you. Yeah. There's some sort of quid pro quo. There's some sort of transactional thing there.
And getting help is weakness.
Yeah. So like we ourselves put up barriers to both us helping other people and letting people help us.
Yeah.
So I think there's so much in those three words that like I am very tempted to explore that and really kind of think about and process what that means to me in my life and to the lives of those around me, because
it's a good pursuit.
Every time I watch that, every time I hear that dialogue, it burrows into my brain somehow, as though like I have some sort of receiver in my brain that's like, you're supposed to be getting something from this right now. Like, mm-hmm. pay attention to this. I need to train myself to pay more attention when I get those signals like that.
Yeah, it's a download, man. And it's something that, you know, dear listener, you know, find that signal in your own life, right? We're all going to we're all going to bring to the table what we can bring, right? Like, never bring more than you're able. But I think we all have that capacity to bring goodness into this world and be good for another human being. And unlike that poor unhoused person who vaporizes himself in this, your life matters. Every single one of us. We are all little miracles on this earth, whether you believe in a higher power or not. The statistical probability of you, the individual person being here, is so wildly out of sorts that you know, we've all got something to offer. We've all got something to give, and we've all got something to contribute. And if we stay in our own little bubbles, then maybe that's the worst kind of death. To not actually be able to achieve or to get that contribution out into the world. So I that's my hope for everybody, kind of thinking about sort of how this episode runs, you know. I mean, whether or not Kirk loses, at least he loved, right? Yeah. And nothing can ever take that away. As sad as he is and the swear that he gets away with, for 60s TV, the swear he gets away with, let's get the hell out of here. Same time, you know, sure he lost, but it's better to have loved and lost than to have never loved at all.
I think that's the perfect place to leave our discussion here. Well, thank you everybody so much for listening and watching. Of course, as you know, We're putting these out on YouTube as well, so be sure to check that out. If you haven't been watching the episodes, you get to see our smiling faces throughout, which is...
And our dirty basements.
Yay.
Yours is great.
Well, this little corner of it is great. Do not look at what's in front of me. It is terrible.
Wait, let's see there. Man, yeah, no, it's pristine the way I'm looking.
Well, thank you all so much for listening. Be sure to check out the Positively Trek discussion group on Facebook if you'd like to weigh in about these episodes. And as always, for crying out loud, stay positive. Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.